This is the Bible Show. Welcome, folks, to another episode of the Bible Show. My name is Sam. Joining me today is Will, and we are going into part two in our episode of Noah and the Flood. Will, what happened in our last episode? Catch us up.
Well, the flood's wild, first off.
Definitely wild.
I think two ways we looked at it, if you broke it down like that last episode. We didn't, but this is how I'm thinking of it now, is the spiritual element of it, of that the world was wicked, we're wicked, our hearts turn inwards to ourselves, that God had only a couple of options, and from the outset he chose the option in Noah that is going to lead to his son dying.
Mm-hmm.
And Noah, even just the whole idea that he walked with God, and that's how he found favor, was the grace that God gave him in that, and then God chose his family to survive. That one man still survives and brings about the new creation. And then on the physical side, just the whole idea of the flood and really imagining a flood that kills birds, because I've never thought about that until you talked about last episode. Like, birds could have just flown and then just sat on top of the water. Yeah, they wouldn't have had food, but they maybe figured that out. But that this was so violent that there was enough water coming from, you know, what is that, the undercrust, or what did you call it?
Springs, the mantles.
The mantles and all of those things, to be like, okay, if glaciers actually did this, if rain actually fell, if waters burst forth from the earth, then, yeah, we're topping the mountains in this.
Yeah, so it would have been a wild, wild world to live in at this time. And so we talked about how Noah lived and was building this thing for decades, right? Yeah. He was a preacher of righteousness. Nobody ultimately follows him. And then when we get into the story of the flood, one of the things as we go into today's episode that I just want to remind everybody of, because we're going to be building on this, is, you know, like you said, God chose the path that would cost him. He could have wiped out the world and he would have lost humanity, which he was unwilling to do. He could have just allowed the world to continue in sin, and it would hurt him because he's holy and just. But he chooses the path that will require him to give the most, which is the path of the cross, to redeem Noah, to move forward with a redeemed humanity. But then as you go through the story, you start noticing a couple of things like that point you back to the creation, and that's intentional, because we talked about how all life on earth comes from Adam, right? There's one other person that all of life on earth stems through. Who's that?
Noah.
Noah, right? He's going to have three sons, and they go out into different nations and everything else. But both Adam and Noah are common ancestors to everyone alive today. They're the only two people in human history that you could say that of. So Noah's going to be a different kind of Adam. And then the story starts coming at you with things like, okay, here's all these animals according to their kinds, according to their kinds, according to their kinds, which takes you right back to Genesis 1 and creation. And you're like, well, that's weird. And he's coming two by two to Adam to name him. They're coming two by two to Noah to come on the ark. And you're like, hey, that's a lot like Adam too. Then, you know, the creatures that have the breath of life in their nostrils, that reminds me of creation again. And so all of this is kind of cueing and teeing you up to see that this is another creation. By the way, you've been introduced to Noah, who has three sons. Guess who else had three sons? Adam, who had Cain, Abel, and Seth, right? So then you have Noah, who's got Ham, Japheth, and Shem. So there's so many things that are cueing you up to understand that God is about to bring about a new beginning. It's another Adam, and he's kind of laying out the story in very similar ways, even to the fact that when the flood comes, we talked about this, that it's kind of undoing what he did in the original creation, where, you know, he starts with, you know, all these creatures being created, and in day three, the trees come forth, and days five, the birds and the fish come forth, and day six, the mammals and man come forth. Well, what happens with the flood is all of those creatures are annihilated, the trees are covered, they all die. Then you get back to the waters, where initially God separated the waters vertically and horizontally. Well, no, now the floods of the deep are coming up, and the rains are coming down, and the land is getting covered. And it's telling you, there is a recreation or an uncreation happening, and God's about to start from a clean slate, which is where we're going to pick up today at the end of chapter 7. It says, he blotted out every living thing that was on the face of the ground, man and animals and creeping things and birds of the heavens. They were blotted out from the earth. Only Noah was left and those that were with him in the ark. The only things that survived the judgment are in the ark. And remember, we talked about, what is the ark foreshadowing?
Jesus.
Jesus. It's the only ones who make it through the judgment. And the waters prevailed on the earth for 150 days. And so if you're imagining the story, there's something called chiasm in Hebrew literature, in the biblical literature, where there's a peak to the story. And on each side, you'll hear repetition. So, for example, you have, you know, it rains for 7 days, and over here it recedes 7 days. 150 days, the water abates, and over here it's going to decline for 150 days. The center point of the story, which in biblical chiastic literature means it's the most important, it's the peak of the story, comes in chapter 8, verse 1. And then you see the repetition on either side of it. And it's this: but God remembered Noah. Now, if you're someone who, if you love the attribute of faithfulness in God, this is your verse. Because when it says that God remembered Noah, like in the English language, how do your ears hear that?
Oh, Noah, he's still in that ark.
Yeah,
right.
Where
someone should get him.
Like God moved on with his life and it's like, oh, Noah, you know, like suddenly
forgot about him.
I got to go fix it. But that's not at all what the Hebrew means. It means he's keeping his covenant. He's honoring his promise. So think of it this way. For communion at the Last Supper, Jesus takes bread, he breaks it, he gives it to his disciples, gives thanks, you know, and then he says, do this in
remembrance
of me. Now, what is Jesus not saying? Go about your lives and forget about me. But when you do this, I want you to be like, oh, yeah, that Jesus guy. Like, no, it's do this in honoring what I've done for you. And so now God comes and he remembered that same idea. It's honoring the covenant with Noah. He has not backed away. So the waters are abating, you know, they're coming up for 150 days. Then we're at the peak of the story, the height of the waters. Then God remembered Noah. He's making good on his promise. This is not going to continue forever. The judgment is going to end. A new beginning is coming. And from this point on, the flood comes down on the other side, and God's about to do a new thing with Noah.
And just to trust that, because in this story, God is destroying the earth that he created. Mm-hmm. There is a moment where if Noah didn't trust God, he'd want God not to remember him. Like forget about me, God. Let me go do my own thing. But here it is. Like, Noah believes that God's a gracious God. Mm-hmm. And the best thing that can happen for you and I is that a gracious God remembers us exactly how we are.
Yeah, I mean, that's
the hope.
I mean, that's the thief on the cross. Remember me when you come into your kingdom. It's not, you know, hey, Jesus, you know, oh, yeah, that thief on the cross. It's honor the gospel promise. Like, God will remember you. He keeps his promises. That's the idea here. And so Noah has spent, you got to think, like, we imagining what Noah's experiencing. I mean, he's been in this ark for months. And you're wondering, like, when does this end? When do I get out of this thing? Is God's judgment ever going to stop?
Sure.
Well, yes. All the beasts and the livestock that were with him in the ark, they're all, God remembered them all. And now listen to the way that he describes it. Because remember our creation stuff? You've got Noah, who's the new Adam and a new creation and everything else. Listen to what he does. And God made a wind. Now, we've talked about this before in previous episodes. What's that Hebrew word?
The ruah.
Ruach, right? It's wind, spirit, or breath. It's always that word. So a spirit blows over the earth and the water subsided. What does that sound like? A ruach on the waters. We're back to Genesis chapter 1, verse 2, where, you know, in the beginning there's darkness and chaotic waters and no life. And what does God do? He's brings the spirit to hover, to descend upon the waters, and then he's going to say, let there be light, right? So now we have the ruach on the surface of the waters, and the fountains of the deep and the windows of the heaven were closed, and the rain from the heavens were restrained, and now the waters receded from the earth continually, and at the end of 150 days, there's that mention. Remember, we're chiastic, so we've got mentioned on one side, it's mentioned on the other. 150 days, the waters had abated, and in the seventh month, on the 17th day of the month, the ark came to rest on the mountains of Ararat. Now, this is really cool. And if you don't know any better, you read right past this. But something big is going on when it tells us that. Now, Noah wouldn't have known this, but we know this in hindsight, and it's this. When it says the 17th day of the seventh month, that lands in the Hebrew calendar on Nisan 17. Nisan, not the car. It's the name of the Hebrew month. Do you know what else happens on Nisan 17?
I do, but I don't want to steal your thunder.
A lot of stuff. The crossing of the Red Sea happens on Nisan 17. Joshua comes into the land and first fruits, Nisan 17. The deliverance of in the book of Esther, the deliverance of the Jews, Nisan 17. And the greatest one, the coup de grace, the resurrection of Jesus Christ takes place on Nisan 17. So let's go back and rehearse this story. God comes to Noah, says that there's a great wickedness on the world, and now as a result of that, I'm going to purge that wickedness. I'm going to have a new beginning. I'm going to judge the earth. And he pours forth water, and he tells Noah to get in the ark. And do you remember what the name ark in Hebrew means?
Coffin.
Yeah, it stems from the Egyptian word tebat, which means coffin or chest. He's saying, go into the coffin, and there you're going to find life. This great coffin of a boat, there you'll find life. And it comes down to rest on Mount Ararat, which nobody really knows how that word or that name came to be. It's referred to as a holy mountain. But when you look at the stem, the root of the name Ararat, the word for curse, when God curses the serpent in Genesis 3, the Hebrew word there is arar. So Ararat, they believe, some people argue, can mean a reversal of the curses is the name of that mountain. And so now I want you to get this, that the coffin, the ark, which is emblematic of who? It's Jesus. Foreshadowing Jesus. Comes down to rest on top of Ararat, the curse on the 17th of Nisan, which is all anticipating the greater fulfillment of what this is all about, where the greater ark is going to triumph over the curses, literally reversing all of the curses. Go back to our Genesis 3 episode and triumph over sin and death on Nisan 17. And so here you've got this, what seems to be prophetic look of what's going on in the days of Noah that's actually pointing you to Christ.
That's wild.
It is wild.
I mean, that's kind of crazy if you think about Nisan 17 not just being, oh, what a coincidence. All of these major deliverance events happening against the Bible saying, no, look at this.
Yeah, that means God is totally in charge in the middle of all the chaotic stuff, right? You think, I mean, the evils of the world and the violence of the days of Noah, and then fast forward and you think, oh, they crossed the Red Sea on Nisan 17. Well, you think about all the suffering in Egypt and all the chaos in Egypt, and it's like God is so perfectly in control that the deliverance is brought on the exact day, and all these major stories, on the exact day of where he has ordained the resurrection to take place, which means the cross is no accident. It means that the days in the tomb are no accident. It means that God is in absolute sovereign control, and we can trust them that even in the midst of the chaos and the darkness and the judgment, that he is accomplishing his ends, and he will be victorious as he is here. And it's all singing about the resurrection, absolutely singing about the resurrection. And so the waters continue to abate, and so Noah doesn't leave the ark. He stays in, you know, who knows what's out there.
For a long time.
For quite a while. Like, we got another 3 months.
I mean, we fast forward through this a lot.
Yeah. So imagine resting on a mountain, and you still can't go out. Like, I'd have some serious
cabin fever. Yeah, imagine getting to your hotel and be like, you got to sit in this car for 3 more months.
Dude, I couldn't do it. Like, Noah's amazing. I'd be going out of my mind. I remember being in the hospital when my kids were born, and it's like you're waiting for the last doctor to sign off on something you can be discharged, and you're like, get me out of here. So anyway, at the end of 40 days, so there's a repetition of 40 days on the other side of God remembering Noah. Noah opened the window of the ark that he had made and sent forth a raven. It went to and fro until the waters were dried up from the earth. Then he sent forth a dove from him. So just real quick, why
change the birds?
That's what I was about to ask you. I think in all cultures that are subsequent to this, like I don't know of any deviation from this, but every time you find a raven in ancient mythology and literature, Edgar Allan Poe, like What is the raven always emblematic of?
Death, like where the raven death. Is, somebody's dead.
That's right. It is a bird of death in a sense. And so the first one that he sends out, there's no hope. It goes to and fro until all the waters are dried up from its earth. It doesn't bring any hope. It's gloomy, right? But then he shifts to a dove, which is just like, why does he shift? I don't know.
I mean, isn't that, the dove's more of the biblical imagery that we see all throughout scripture, at least after this, you know, a dove descends at Jesus' baptism.
Yeah, the Holy Spirit descends as a dove, like the
sacrificial
doves.
Mm-hmm.
So you're going to find that. The dove is the picture of the Holy Spirit. In all ancient cultures, what does the dove symbolize? Like, you release doves at a wedding because they symbolize love. They symbolize peace. They symbolize all these kind of pure elements, right? And so then, number two, he sends forth a dove to see if the waters had subsided from the face of the ground. The dove found no place to set her foot, so she returned to him in the ark, for the waters were still on the face of the whole earth. So they're on a mountain, peeking up above the waters, but the waters are still going down. So he put his hand and took her and brought her into the ark with him. He waited another 7 days, so there's the 7 days on the other side of the chiasm, and again he sent forth the dove out of the ark. And the dove came back to him in the evening, and behold, in her mouth was a freshly plucked olive leaf. Now, what do you think of when you hear olives? If I said extending an olive branch to you, what does that mean?
Peace.
Peace. So what's going on here? So all this symbolism, you've got a raven, well, that's death. A dove, that's the Holy Spirit. That's love. That's also peace. That's beauty. It's purity. So that element is in the story, and all these cultures mimic that for the rest of time, right? I think it comes from a common memory of this, where it's like this got the ball rolling of having these impressions of these creatures or olive branches, right? In the ancient world, if you went to Athens, the olive was super important. It's what fueled the Olympic torch. It's what the Olympic winners wore on their head. If you go to Jerusalem in the temple, it's what, you know, the lampstand was fueled by olive oil. The cherubim angels on the Ark of the Covenant were carved out of olive wood. Like, olive becomes this really, really sacred thing all over the world in the ancient world. Even in the United States, if you look at our seal, you have the eagle, and the eagle's holding two different things in their talents. One of them is 13 arrows, 13 colonies going to war, right? And the other one, it's an olive branch. And then the eagle is turned toward the olive branch for peace. So we see that even on the American seal, like, olives represent peace, right? So how did this come about? Like, what about this story is suggesting peace? Well, this is where God is calling a truce, right? So the dove comes. Remember, the dove is this emblematic of the Spirit, and now it's over the waters, and it's marking a new beginning, and death is behind. Which, by the way, that in and of itself is pointing you to baptism. You've mentioned it earlier, right? What happens? You have Jesus, the true ark, right, that we need to be inside of to escape judgment. When he goes into the waters of the Jordan to be baptized, what happens? The Holy Spirit comes down as a dove upon him. So now if you're thinking, wait a minute, Noah, he's the greater ark. Now you have the Spirit descending on the greater ark in the waters. What's it announcing? A new beginning is here. Death, what is baptism a picture of? Death is past. New life is beginning. Peter, in his epistle, talks about how Noah is saved through the waters, and that's a picture of baptism. And that leads you to Christ, where you see a new beginning marked by the dove descending on him in the waters. Death is past, new beginning is coming. Like, the Bible's very, very intentional about that. And here's one of the things that I think is really fascinating, and this is take this for what it's worth. It's a Sam original. Jesus gives one major sermon about the end times and the second coming. It's in Matthew 24. You know what it's called? The Olivet Discourse. You know why it's called the Olivet Discourse? Because he gives the Sermon on the Mount of
Olives.
Olives. So here's Jesus, and this is the only time that Jesus in his entire life ever mentions Noah. He says that it will be the second coming of the apocalypse, all that stuff. It will be as it was in the days of
Noah.
And what is he surrounded by as he gives that message?
Olives.
Olives. What did olives signify to Noah?
waters are gone, peace has arrived.
Judgment's done. God is at peace again with us. And here's Jesus, who's the greater ark, the greater Noah, who is saying there's coming another worldwide judgment. And he's delivering this sermon on a Mount of Olives. It's like he's surrounded by olive branches. It's not just a dove bringing a leaf. It's here is the rescue. Here is God's good news. And he is surrounded by olives. And here's I'll take you one further.
One step further.
And the crazy train.
Wow.
Where is Jesus when he's betrayed?
In the Garden of Gethsemane.
Which is at the foot of the Mount of Olives, right? Gethsemane is an Aramaic word. It literally means oil press. And it's where they would take all of the olives once they're ripe and they turn from green to red and they're kind of filled up with oil. You go over there today, to this day, you can watch this, and they'll take a big club or stick and they beat the olive tree, and the olives that are filled up with the oil that have turned reddish will drop, and then they take those olives and they'll go to a press and they'll lay them on a stone and they roll this massive cylinder stone across them, and it crushes the olive, and you see the olive oil just drip down over the side going down, and then they collect the olive oil and it's used for healing. It's used for lighting the temple lampstand. It's used for all sorts of things, right? So Jesus, think about that. It is the crushing of this olive that gives forth the substance that brings light, that brings healing, that brings all these things that they used olive oil for, flavor. When Jesus goes to Gethsemane, it's like he is a picture of that. Lord, I don't want to go to the cross, but it's not my will, yours be done. And he is under such agony. He is so crushed under the weight of this responsibility that what begins to happen to him at Gethsemane?
Like perspirates blood.
He begins to sweat blood. It's like when he's crushed, the substance that brings light, the substance that brings healing comes out of him when he's under the stress of the oil press. But it's far, far greater than an oil press.
And that's just straight biblical. I mean, Isaiah 53:5, but he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. Yeah. The punishment that brought us peace was upon him.
Yeah, it says that it pleased, in other words, it gave the Father a good emotion to crush him because he knew what he was getting.
Yeah.
And it uses that word, crushing. That's what Jesus endures. And so it's all this imagery that involves the olive and what's happening. You know, he's going to be beat. He's going to be squeezed and crushed, and his substance comes forward. But this olive leaf gives hope to Noah, and it says he knew that the waters had subsided from the earth. And then he waited another 7 days and sent forth a dove, and she did not come back anymore because there were trees to build nests in once again. And so at that point, the earth is dry. Noah removed the covering from the ark, and look and behold, the face of the ground was dry. In the second month, on the 27th day of the month, the earth had dried out, and God said to Noah, go out from your ark, you and your wife and your sons' wives with you, and bring out with you every living thing that is with you, all flesh, birds and animals and creeping things that creep on the earth, that they may swarm on the earth. And then listen to what he says. Be fruitful and multiply on the earth. What's that take you to?
Right back to Adam and Eve.
Right back to Adam and Eve. So here you have Noah and his wife and his three sons that are coming out, and all the creatures are now going forth. And he says, be fruitful and multiply. We're back to the great cultural mandate. Noah went out, and his sons and his wives with him. Every beast, every creeping thing, every bird, everything that moves on the earth went out by families from the ark. Then Noah built an altar to the Lord, because what does Noah do? He walks with God. He gets done with this, and the first thing that he wants to do, he's not commanded to, by the way, but he wants to. He worships. He builds an altar, and he took some of every clean animal and every clean bird and offered burnt offerings on the altar. And when the Lord smelled the pleasing aroma, he said in his heart, I will never again curse the ground because of man, for the intention of man's heart is evil from his youth. There it is. So now we're on the other side of the flood. You remember why God first caused the flood?
The evil in their hearts.
Yeah, because man's every intention of his heart was only evil continually. And now he's saying, I'll never curse the ground again because of man. In other words, I'm not going to cause this to fall upon the world because the intention of man's heart is evil from his youth, from infancy, from toddlers. This is who they are. So we're going to have a different salvation story here to rescue them from that evil intent that's in their heart. So we're on the other side of the flood, and that's still the diagnosis for us. Yeah, how are you feeling about that?
That keeps us humble, because we could just say, well, if God hasn't flooded us again, we're obviously not as bad as they were, but now it's just like, no, I easily could have. I'm just choosing not to this time.
Every capacity to follow that, apart from the restraining grace of God or the Spirit at work within us, right? So we have no reason to boast. And he says, neither will I strike down every living creature as I have done while the earth remains. Seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night shall not cease. In other words, I am not going to interrupt with some cataclysmic event that throws. So think about what that means that the flood did. It threw seasons upside down. No summer, winter, like who knows what happened to the atmosphere. Like something happened that was super cataclysmic. And he's saying, nope, going forward, there's going to be seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night. Because during the cataclysm, all those categories got thrown upside down for a while. So think about how violent and wild that must have been. So we're continuing toward the new creation. Chapter 9, it says, and God blessed Noah and his sons and said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. The fear of you and the dread of you shall be upon every beast of the earth and upon every bird of the heavens, upon everything that creeps on the ground and all of the fish of the sea. And to your hand they're delivered. You reign. You're my ambassador. You have dominion, in other words. Every moving thing that lives shall be food for you. So now every category is opened up. And as I gave you the green plants, now I give you everything. But you shall not eat flesh with its life, that is its blood. And so this is where the beginning of, like what he's saying is.
Yeah, what does that mean?
Well, it's like you be respectful in how you're not an animal. You can't go kill something and eat it while it's still alive. Like, be deliberate in how you honor what you eat. In other words, not while it's still has lifeblood flowing through it. You're going to cook it well. And for your lifeblood, I will require a reckoning. Remember, prior to this, you've got Lamech murdering.
Yeah.
Now God says, I'm going to require a reckoning. From every beast, I will require it, and from man. From his fellow man, I will require a reckoning for the life of man. Whoever sheds the blood of man, by man his blood shall be shed, for God made man in his own image. And so here you have God coming to Noah saying, from this point forward, I want absolute justice for human life. They're made in my image. They have absolute and utter dignity. If you take a life, your life is forfeit. And this is where a lot of people say that you have the institution of government created. Prior to this, out of the gates, you get marriage is the first institution. Like, God creates Adam and Eve, then he gives them a family, so you see the family. Then they begin to call on the name of the Lord, so you have peoples of faith. So you see, in some sense, a church or a community of faith that comes together. So you have marriage, the family, the church, and here, now you have God that says, I want humanity to organize in a principle that protects the image of God, the Imago Dei, the integrity and the dignity of humanity. I want formal protections for, and this institutes, in some sense, a government.
Yeah, it's a stopgap. Because, before the flood, they were violent. They weren't just listening to each other saying, oh, you're in the image of God, I should protect that. They didn't care.
Mm-hmm. But when you think of that, the way I like to think of it is, what is, if in terms of institutions that God brings forth, what's the most essential? Marriage, family, church,
government,
which is much.
Well, less I thought you were going pro-government there, and I was kind of confused. No. I was like,
"Well, God institutes governments, but He institutes governments because humanity's wickedness needs restraining." That's something the primary point of what He's doing. He's not saying, "Oh, the government shall be because its job is
to take you guys care can't stop killing each other."
Yeah. The government is to restrain evil. It's to promote justice. And so you can take that for what it's worth. But then he goes on and he says, and you be fruitful and multiply, increase greatly on the earth and multiply in it. Then God said, so let's pause there for a moment and we go through this is a new creation. Like, it's undeniable how God is establishing this. This is the baptism of the world. The world has perished, and now God is starting a new thing. Be fruitful, multiply. He's the new Adam, all the new commandments, except now God is opening up more. You know, you're able to eat whatever. You have a government now. And laws that are starting to come upon all of human. This applies to all of humanity, not just, you know, remember, Noah is it and his sons. So this is all of humanity now under this law.
And almost you can kind of feel the excitement in God. It's like, okay, God, we get it. You said be fruitful and multiply a bunch of times in these last couple of paragraphs. But he's like almost excited to get humanity back up to a place, which is interesting. Like, oh, if I just had to destroy all of humanity because they were evil, I wouldn't be like, let's get this going fast again. I'd be like, okay, everyone take a chill pill. But here's God's like, no, come on, guys. Let's get the earth back. I want to be with my people again.
That's really a good point. And it's like we said in the last episode, you know, a lot of times we don't imagine God as a character in his story that he's ordaining, right? You know, but he's actually the one who experiences heartache. He's the one who is the most selfless one here, because the only way Noah gets to live is if God commits to the cross. The only way he gets redeemed. And here, you, like you said, that's really beautiful that God's not like, all right,
yes, guys,
two.
Let's do this again.
He really is like, I want you to have children. I want to see my design, my garden, in a sense, spread to the ends of the world. Make it beautiful. Here we go again. And that's awesome. And then God does something that is just awesome. Then God said to Noah and his sons with him, behold, I will establish my covenant with you and your offspring after you. Who does that apply to?
All of us, because we're all from Noah.
Yeah. So remember, like, the covenant with the nation of Israel doesn't happen until you get Jacob, which is well into Genesis. So all of the covenants with Adam, with Noah, these are for all of humanity. Hmm. God's covenant of grace, the promise of one to crush the head of the serpent, that's to everybody. The covenant of mercy, which comes to Noah here, that's to everybody. And listen to what God says. Behold, I establish my covenant with you. This is not a bilateral covenant. He's not saying, if you do this, then I will do my part. He says, look, I'm establishing my covenant with you and your offspring after you and with every living creature that is with you, the birds, the livestock, and every beast of the earth with you. As many as came out of the ark, it is for every beast of the earth. I will establish my covenant with you that never again shall all flesh be cut off by the waters of the flood, and never again shall there be a flood to destroy the earth. This one and for all time humanity baptism in the flood is never going to be repeated again. And, you know, there's a lot of people think that when, because the chapter's not long after this, you have them building a tower, the Tower of Babel, and you see ziggurats all over. In the early days of Judaism, the belief was that they built those towers because they did not trust God not to flood.
Huh.
So in places where you didn't have high mountains to escape to,
that
they built artificial towers reaching into the heavens to be able to escape to. That's what Josephus talked about. But God is saying, I will not flood the earth again. And then he does something just awesomely beautiful, right?
Yeah, what a kindness from God to even let Noah in on this, and likewise us. Because he could just, you know, within himself be like, I won't do that again. Mm-hmm. But then Noah would, and his descendants would be like, every time it rained, he'd be like, it's going to stop?
Yeah.
Like, how terrifying would that be? So it's very gracious to be like, okay, Noah, let me in. I'll let you in on this.
That's good. Yeah. So then God says, this is the sign of the covenant that I make between me and you and every living creature that is with you. For all future generations, I have set my bow in the cloud, and it shall be a sign of the covenant between me and the earth. Now, what's different about that? Because it doesn't say rainbow. When we hear that, we go, oh, rainbow. I've set my rainbow in the clouds. But that's not what is happening here. It literally is saying, I have set my bow. You look at the Hebrew word there, it is a weapon of war. I have set my bow, like my bow and arrow, in the clouds. And that is the sign of the covenant between me and the earth. Now, you were talking about a piece of old art that depicted a covenant. and somebody with a bow. You want to talk about
that? Yeah, it's interesting. I'll try to find it and send it so maybe we can see it. But it's an interesting, it's not a picture, whatever, a piece of art, because you have, obviously, the leader is on the left side. It's clear that he's in charge. Mm-hmm. And then you have a bow that looks like a parentheses mark, and the bow is facing that leader. And then you have a bunch of subjects that are bowing down to him, because it's interesting that obviously some deal is being formed here. Mm-hmm. But just like in this instance with God, you would expect the guy in charge to have the bow wielding against his subjects, but it's the exact opposite. Yeah. That the bow is actually facing the one making the covenant.
That's right. So when you think about it, I mean, and think about it from in terms of heaven and earth.
Yeah.
When God sets his bow in the sky, when you look up at the sky, which way is the bow pointing?
Luckily, it's up.
It's pointing to the heavens, which means that if there ever has to be a great judgment again, which way is that bow firing?
Right at God.
And to the heavens. And that's exactly what happens. When the next time that God will bring a worldwide flood, it's not going to be by water. He keeps his word. It'll be by fire next time. But even then, God makes a way of mercy for all people. That bow is pointed to the heavens, and it will strike Jesus, who reigns in heaven, and he will be the one that takes the next judgment on the cross to make a way for everybody to avoid the next judgment, to become the ark, to take all the sin away from humanity, to die for sin, to be raised from the dead, to purchase an afterlife for all of us. And then he says, as many as come to me, you will not face judgment. Romans 8:1, there's now no condemnation for those that are in Christ Jesus. Not even a little bit. No condemnation. It has all been extinguished. Why? Because the bow was turned toward heaven, and God took the judgment upon himself to give humanity a path toward mercy. And that picture, you know, that the picture of the rainbow in the sky that's always up there, that when you look up, it's a reminder that God's weapon of war is pointed at himself rather than at us. That's his heart for us. That's incredible to me that an infinite God with infinite capacities and attributes so loves us, even after this, that he would say, I'll take the arrow before I let it fall on you. At least I'm going to give you a way to avoid the arrow by taking it myself. The question is, will you be in me? Will you hide behind me so that the arrow to come doesn't land on you? That's wild.
Yeah, what a wild thing that we still get to see it today. Like, even you and I, like, if it rains today, we're going to see a rainbow, and that's God reminding you and I today of who he is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and how utterly typical of humanity that we have taken that very sign that is the perfect picture of God's selflessness and his willing to lay down his life for us, and we've turned it into a symbol of perversity. And to do exactly what God commands not to do, to abandon his design, to make it all about us and our pleasures and what we want, and then we hijack that very symbol and make it about wickedness. It's, I mean, there's humanity again.
Pride.
Mm-hmm. And yet for everybody that's chasing all that stuff, like, God is still there begging, pleading, heartbroken, come to me. I do not want this for you. Get inside the ark. But yeah, his goodness is phenomenal. So verse 14, it says, when I bring clouds over the earth and the bow is seen in the clouds. Now, when you look up and you see the storm clouds, if you're Noah and it's a fresh mark, like you said, every time you see the storm brewing, it's like, maybe some PTSD.
Yeah, I've never seen water burst forth from the ground either, so just know.
And Noah's sons, like, the kindness is in the midst of the storm, remember that God has put that bow there for a reason. It's to say, even in the midst of the storm, my promise does not leave you. Which is just awesome.
And when we've experienced, like, floods are scary. Like, our city recently has begun to flood in a way that, like, I don't like to see storm clouds, and I'm not dying over them. Yeah. It's just an inconvenience to get home, or my car gets flooded.
Yeah.
So even now, I'm like, ooh, let's stop this rain.
Not a fan of the flood. We lost our van, or at least functionality in our van, because of a flood. We had two once in a century floods back to back.
Interesting years. How they want to.
So it says, when the bow is in the clouds, I will see it and remember the everlasting covenant between God and every living creature of all flesh that is on the earth. And God said to Noah, this is the sign of the covenant that I have established between me and all flesh that's on earth.
It's interesting that it's God seeing the rainbow. I've never thought about that.
Sure.
It's God. Say that again. Sorry.
When the bow is in the clouds, I will see it and remember the everlasting covenant. Like, it seems like a gift to us, but it's actually God being like, no, I saw that bow and I'll remember that covenant.
Yeah, there's a verse in Revelation somewhere. I don't know where, but it talks about how God on his throne, do you know what's right above his throne? A circle of the rainbow. Now, which is interesting because if you see satellites from space, pictures of, they're actually circles. But to us, because they go over the horizon, they look like bows.
Really?
Really, yeah. You can look it up.
Look.
Yeah. But so from our perspective, it looks like the bow pointing to the heavens. In Revelation, it actually refers to the circle of the rainbow is above the throne. So this covenant of mercy, like as God is watching the wickedness of earth, even to this moment and all the awful things that are happening and his wrath and everything else is storing up behind the dam of his patience, that rainbow, which is always the sign of his desire for mercy, is above his throne.
Mm.
So you think of God, the throne of God, you think, power and, wrath pouring forth. No, it's marked by it has that for sure, but it's marked by the rainbow, which is the reminder that he was willing to take the judgment if only people would come to him. Otherwise, that wrath is reserved for you, which is a terrifying thought. And so it says, the sons of Noah went forth from the ark with Shem, Ham, and Japheth. They were the three sons. And it says, Noah. So now, remember, we're in the Adam parallel, new beginning, great. Okay, we get off the ark, the two-by-twos, the according to their kinds, all of those things. So now we get, in verse 20, we get to, how did the story of Adam end? Well, it doesn't end great. he falls. He does a lot of shameful things. And so now we've got this character, Noah, who has walked with God, who's been blameless, who's been wonderful, that all of humanity is rescued by, God's favor toward him because he's been faithful. And now you see Noah, the end of his story is one of like, oh, man, which, by the way, that's the entirety of the Old Testament. You get hero after hero after hero, David and Solomon and Noah and Adam, and you go down the line where it's like, oh, maybe this guy is going to be the hero that doesn't fail, and it's always, oh, man.
Yeah, the Bible very quickly says, nope.
Yep, and it's whetting your appetite for a hero who will not fail, which comes to us in the New Testament with Jesus. But prior to that, it's showing person after person, regime after regime, method of dealing with God after method of dealing with God, nothing. We can't be saved. We cannot save ourselves. We need heaven to come down and save us is the message of the Old Testament. So in verse 20, we get into the fall of Noah. And the way that it tells us about the fall of Noah is interesting. It says, Noah began to be a man of the soil, and he planted a vineyard. Now, what is a vineyard?
Place where you get wine.
Or a place grapes. Grow grapes, but it's fruit, right? So Adam is in a garden. He's planting a garden. There's fruit trees and everything else. Noah plants, and it's a vineyard, which is fruit vines, right? So you have, this is where you're going to make wine.
And even Cain was a man of the soil.
That's right. So you hear those echoes going on. It says, he drank of the wine and became drunk and lay uncovered in his tent. You're like, whoa, that sentence came out of nowhere. So verse 21, it's telling you that Noah took from the fruit and he drank. He didn't eat. He drank. And then, as we'll see, he's going to be shamed in his nakedness. Does that sound familiar?
Yeah.
This is Adam all over again. You had Adam in a garden, right? Like, everything was good. It's all brand new. Like, here we go. You got the brand new car. Let's take it for a spin. And he eats from the fruit. And he then experiences the shame of nakedness. Here you have Noah, who drinks of the fruit, becomes drunk, and is going to experience the shame of nakedness. So, like, why is he naked in his tent uncovered? We don't know. And if you go back and you read, like, the Babylonian Talmud and some of the ancient rabbis, there's a lot of different theories on what's going on here. I'd take the innocent one, the most innocent one, which is that he just gets drunk and passes out naked. There's others who believe that his son Ham, who we get introduced to in this next verse, says, "And Ham, the father of Canaan, saw the nakedness of his father and told his two brothers outside." Now, the rabbis say he must have done something. There's theories that he castrated Noah. There's theories that he sexually came upon Noah while he was drunk and passed out. Those are crazy to me. Like, I don't.
That's a lot to take from that sentence.
I don't see why, but that was pretty popular among the rabbis going back in history.
Do you think that's just because what we'll see is it seems like a sentence that was far greater than what happened? So yeah. You had to make the act to fit the punishment.
100%. So God is going to bring down a justice where you're like, whoa, just for pointing out his father's nakedness? And so what happens here says, and this is what you're to see here. Ham is looking at his father's nakedness and what's in his heart. When I see you stumbling into sin or shame, is my heart to go, oh, everybody come look. Look at what Will has done and to heap shame and to destroy your reputation and to bring shame and dishonor upon you and to... Is that my heart or is that, oh my goodness, he's stumbling. I need to protect him from himself.
Yeah, because the brother's response is different than Ham's.
In the heart, there's a murder of his reputation here in the heart of Ham. Ham is looking at his dad with contempt and wants everyone else to see, oh yeah, this is the godly one. Come look. Come
he doesn't look, cover come see. Him up.
Doesn't cover him up. Doesn't protect him at all. The response of his, which by that's super instructive. Like, I am so bad at this, especially with people I don't know that are far away, politicians and celebrities, where it's like, you know, I can enter in and just kind of like, ooh, look at them and their destruction and look at how terrible they are. That's not good. That's not good in me at all. The godly thing is what happens with the brothers Shem and Japheth. What did they do? They took a garment. So here we go again. A covering, right? What, that's the godly thing to do. You're naked in shame. I want to bring you a covering. For the Christian, what does that look like?
I mean, Jesus' blood covering us.
That's it. Well, you see a world that struggles with shame, that struggles because they've done things that they're ashamed of, that they're plagued with guilt about. There's two responses. One is Ham that looks at that and goes, look at them. Look how terrible they are. Look at me by comparison. I'm amazing compared to them. Everybody look at them and their fault. And God goes, ugh. And then you get the two sons that take a covering and walk backward.
And don't even look at his shame.
They don't even want to see it. They don't want that image of their father. They want to keep him noble in their own minds. And they come and they lay a covering over their father, which means the hero of the story, the one who's blameless, the one who's righteous, the one who walks with God, even he's in need of a covering. Even he's in need of merciful people that are willing to look past his blemishes, to love him anyway, and to cover him up and to protect his honor. That's godliness. That's amazing. And so right out of the gates here, you've got God who's saying, hey, if you're the kind of person that loves to tear down, God's not about that at all. Not liking that even a little bit. But the ones who are eager to go to the one who's fallen to cover them up, that's honorable. So their faces were turned backward and they did not see their father's nakedness. And when Noah awoke from his wine and knew what his youngest son had done to him, he said, cursed be Canaan. A servant of servants shall he be to his brothers. So now he lays down this curse on Ham's son, Canaan. And all of Canaan's descendants are going to be the ones who inhabit the promised land when Joshua comes back into the land many centuries later. All those tribes that they have to fight to expel out of the promised land, they're descendants of Canaan. It's the Canaanites who dwell there, and even the other tribes that are named stem from Canaan. And it's setting up like these people are going to be the enemies of God. Now, why Noah calls that out, like, why not Ham? Why not the Hamites or whatever? But he doesn't. But it's Canaanites that are going to be seen as the servants to their brothers. And then he says, blessed be the Lord, the God of Shem. Let Canaan be his servant, which is prophetic of what's coming. May God enlarge Japheth and let him dwell in the tents of Shem, and let Canaan be his servant as well. After the flood, Noah lived 350 years. All the days of Noah were 950 years, and he died. And so from this point, we've seen that the new creation, oh, it looks so promising, and then Noah messed it up. And it leaves you longing for one who's better. And by the way, notice the things that are here. How does Adam fall? By eating. How does Noah fall?
Drinking.
By drinking. What does Christ do for us? He redeems us, and then he calls upon us to remember our redemption by doing what?
Communion, which is eating of his flesh, drinking of his blood.
Yeah, so we're redeemed by eating and drinking. He takes even the acts that are corrupted, and he redeems them, right? So eating and drinking are restored, partying and having a good time, and all of that is going to be restored, but it's directed for our minds to honor him and to align with him and to walk with him. That's what the idea is. And Christ is coming to be the better ark, to be the better Adam, to be the better Noah, to make a new heaven and a new earth where sin doesn't even exist. It's all washed away. He is the one who's had the bow of God pointed at him. He's taken the wounding so that you don't have to. And in this case, he is the one who gives the far greater covering that gives you the blessing and protects your reputation in the sight of God. When God sees you, he doesn't know. Like, as far as the east is from the west, so far your sin is removed from him. God doesn't harp on and dwell on the fact of all your moral nakedness or your shamefulness or your inadequacies or anything like that. Like, when God sees you because of Christ, you're totally covered. You're still honorable. You're righteous in his sight, because his son is even far greater than Shem or Japheth. His covering does so much more than what you find in Genesis. And that's something that you come out of the story with, and you can praise God. Like, he's accomplished all of this, except he's done it perfectly. That's our Savior. All right, so in the next chapter, we get into the Table of Nations, and we take those three sons, which it's so cool what God does with these three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And we'll get into how he is casting forward the story of redemption through those and how they pick up again in the New Testament. And we'll get into the Tower of Babel, and that story is so underestimated in terms of its importance for the rest of Scripture. But we'll get into that in our next episode. So make sure that you join us as we move into Genesis 10 with the Table of Nations and Genesis 11 with the Tower of Babel. Join us then. Until then, God bless. Thanks for listening to The Bible Show. If you enjoyed this podcast, please remember to like and subscribe and leave a kind review to help us in the world of tech algorithms. Also, feel free to share with a friend. We'll see you next week with another episode of The Bible Show.